Well, tonight we continue our series on church history. We're at the beginning of the Middle Ages. Just for a quick review, you remember that the Middle Ages, historians have assigned that to history. There's nothing that signified it necessarily with a trumpet sound or a person hollering in the corner, "Now we start the Middle Ages." No, that's not the way it was. But the early church fathers, the patristic period, went into the 600s AD. And then we know the Protestant Reformation began with Martin Luther nailing his 95 Theses to the church door at Wittenberg, October 31st, 1517. In between them is a middle period. That's the Middle Ages. And historians just say it's the middle period between the patristic age and the age of the Reformation, Protestant Reformation. What happened in the 600s that ushered in the Middle Ages was the rise of Islam that we're going to look at further this evening. We looked at it last time we met, kind of some main doctrines and holdings, what it believes, and core things. Aside from the rise of Islam in the 600s, there was the ending of the Chalcedonian Monophysite controversy, which was huge in the Byzantine Empire, causing great conflict and division. That ended because of some of the Islamic conquests, particularly of Syria and Egypt. As well, there was the rise in the 600s of the Frankish Empire. And it reached its peak in 800 AD with the Holy Roman Empire founded under Charlemagne, which ended up then being a separate religious and political entity than the Byzantine Empire in the East, both religiously and politically. And we're going to see why tonight, based on some of the conquests of the Islamic Empire. Okay? You remember Muhammad, born 570, 571, somewhere in there. Remember the biography, the first biography that was done on Muhammad was done 150 years after his death. So it's hard to say whether it's really accurate or not. Right? 150 years is a long time. Just a quick review on his life. His parents died when he was young from Arabia. Think of Saudi Arabia today, in that area of the world. His parents died when he was young. He was raised by an uncle. He was a young shepherd man, shepherding sheep for a while. Then he became a trader, working for a wealthy widow. He married that widow when he was 25. She was 40. They had children, which will play out this evening. Blood descendants came from him. Okay, that'll be part of a civil war that arises, how to handle that, as to who should succeed him once he dies. He claimed to have his first vision in 610. He would go meditate in a cave near Mecca. He claims he had a vision from a messenger, an angel, Gabriel, from God. Allah is Arabic for God. So they speak of Allah, whom they worship in Islam. It's important to understand from an apologetic perspective of Christianity, he claims to have a vision all by himself in a cave. And we have 114 messages, they're called surahs, in the Quran. So he dictated them down as he heard them. It's different than inspiration, the doctrine that we have in the Bible from 2 Timothy 3:16, where God breathed his words out through the minds of the apostles and prophets as they wrote. That's different. Dictation is just, I speak to you, and you write down what you hear. That's what he did for his 114 messages or surahs that are included in the Quran. So the Quran is their revelation from Allah. But no one else was a witness to that. Right? That's very important. Truth is established by at least two or more witnesses. Deuteronomy chapter 19. Who's to say? Right? Very deceptive. Well, he and his followers in 622 in Mecca were driven out by the tribal pagans that were in that area. It was just tribal pagans. He had come across both Judaizers among the Jews and Christians in his travels as a trader, but he did not embrace either of them. He didn't embrace paganism, and he comes up with his own religion, supposedly from the angel Gabriel from Allah. So he claims to be the prophet of Allah, prophet of God. Well, he gets some followers around Mecca. He's driven out in 622 by the pagans militarily. He goes to a northern city, Medina, and he becomes the political and religious leader there, great conversions to Islam. He has a military force that confronts the pagans. By 630 AD, he's back in Mecca triumphant. And then he turns the Kaaba, that, as Amy mentioned last time we met, that weird cube-shaped thing that had been their pagan shrine, their ancient pagan shrine, turned it into the most holy place of Islam in Mecca. That was 630. He dies 2 years later. Okay, I was talking with my father-in-law about all of this within the week after we last met, and he goes, well, how did he die? Well, he didn't die in warfare as you'd think. He actually died with a prolonged high fever and sickness that he ended up dying from. But he died 2 years after conquering Mecca. Well, his followers, the successors to him, were called caliphs, and they spread Islam through the physical sword that we're going to be looking at tonight. Their exodus, when he had to leave Mecca, that in 622, that exodus begins their calendar. He's kind of copying when the Israelites exited from Egypt. That began their calendar. So he's copying some things from Judeo-Christianity. The holy writings that they have are the Quran, the 114 messages from Allah that he wrote down and dictated. From an apologetic perspective, remember, the third caliph accumulated all of the various 114 surahs and messages that were out there. There were contradictions. There were contradictions. Accumulated them all and got it down to one that he felt was the valid 114, burned the rest. Which is why if you're in an argument with one of the Islamic faith, they'll say, well, your Bible has contradictions, which we don't believe it does, but they'll say, your Bible has contradictions. Look at all of the copies and texts that are out there from history. They don't all agree. Ours does not. And you say, now wait a minute. Yours doesn't because you only have one copy because the third caliph burned all the rest that had the contradictions. Okay? And we know that from history. Okay? So that's an apologetic that you can have with them if they ever bring that up with you. You get me? Because that's what they'll be accusing our religious texts of having contradictions, and then they claim they don't. Well, there's one reason. They only have one copy that survived. The third caliph burned the rest. Okay? Well, they had the Quran, then they had the Hadith, the traditions, traditional sayings, and things that Muhammad did that are modeled for us to follow. They're in the Hadith. There's some crazy things written in that. And then the Ijma, I-J-M-A, which is the collected consensus of the legal scholars of Islam. So those are the three authorities within Islam. Hadith, traditional sayings, and things Muhammad did to be a model to follow. That writing, the Hadith writings, and then the Quran, 114 messages from Allah that he dictated, and then the Ijma, the collected consensus of the leaders or the legal authorities, the lawyers of Islam. Well, it spread through the sword. Remember, the view of Islam is that they spread through preaching, writing, diplomacy, which is politics. It's part of their religion, which is why when they get here, over 90% of them vote. It's part of their religion, where the average American, only 40% of us votes. If it keeps up, they can be a small minority and outvote us. You've got to get to the voting booth and vote appropriately, okay? But they spread through preaching, they spread through writing, they spread through diplomacy and politics. Islam means submit in Arabic. That's what it means, submit. So if you're not going to submit to the preaching, the writing, or the diplomacy politics, guess what's coming? Warfare. It's part of their religion, okay? They have the five pillars of Islam, and jihad, the holy struggle, is not a part of the five pillars, but it's just as critical. The five pillars of Islam is first the confession of faith. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Short confession of faith. They believe the Trinity is many gods, three different gods. They don't understand the Trinity, what we're asserting. Three persons in one essence, one God, one substance. But they assert that we have three gods. So we are pagans to them. We are an idol because we defy the oneness of Allah in their mind. Okay? They do believe Jesus Christ is a prophet. They believe Jesus is a prophet. He was virgin born, sinless, did miracles, but not the eternal Son of God. He's not divine. And he didn't die on a cross. In their mind, that's what they say. He's a prophet, but not as great of a prophet as Muhammad. Okay? We covered that. But they're pillars. First one is the confession of faith. There is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. The second, third, and fourth pillars, think with me, they copy Christianity. Jesus, in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6, 1 through 18, three main parts of religion that he discusses there. Charitable giving, almsgiving, then prayer. We have the Lord's Prayer listed, and then fasting. Remember? Matthew 6, 1 through 18. What does he have? In his five pillars, he starts with the confession of faith. Number one, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Then goes into charitable giving, almsgiving. Say they have a duty. Allah's will is to give money to the poor. They're about prayer, but they say you have to pray five times a day facing Mecca. Five times a day facing Mecca. And then fasting. Fasting for them is required during the holy month of Ramadan. And then what I've come across is many of them fast during the daylight hours and feast at night. What's the fifth? Fifth, everybody needs to try and make one pilgrimage to Mecca in their lifetime. That's the fifth pillar of Islam. But remember, they say submit. Islam means submit. If you're not going to submit through their preaching, if you're not going to submit through their writing, then there's the politics and diplomacy. If you're not going to submit through that, warfare is coming. That's the holy war, jihad. Jihad means struggle, and it's a personal struggle to obey Allah's will, as we said, but it's a struggle to make Islam a world-dominating religion, to spread it worldwide. It's part of their religion. That's why we're playing with fire in the Western world by immigrating them in like we do. Okay, mass immigration of them is playing with fire. And that's why I said, as a civil society, you could be cooked pretty quick. Christ will still build his church. Okay, that's what we're going to see. Christ is still going to build his church, even in the midst of what happens here that we're going to review the 100 years after Muhammad's death. It's nothing but military conquest. Okay, I ended last time we met with a question. Why did the Christian world offer so little resistance? Within 100 years of Muhammad's death, died 632, by 732 AD, they had conquered half of the Byzantine Empire that had once been Christendom. We're talking Christendom. Byzantine Empire is Christianity, Catholic Christianity. They conquered Persian Empire. They went all the way to India, to the east. They conquered North Africa, which we're going to be covering, with Morocco, Tunisia, Libya, across northwest Africa. They went into Spain, conquered that, and then even part of France, which we're going to get to. One of the key battles of the entire world history is in Tours, France, northwest France, okay, that we're going to see tonight. But we're going to see another battle with Constantinople, with Constantine IV as well. And you're going to see Islam was only turned back when Christendom, Christians, took up arms and fought them to the death to repel them, their armies and navies. Okay? That's the only thing that repelled them and stopped them. Military fighting. A just war defending life and property and Christianity. But the question I had, in that 100-year period, they spread across that huge, vast area. So that's quick, within 100 years. Why did the Christian world offer so little resistance? Why? We're going to cover that this evening then, okay? This is point three in the outline. Point three in the outline, the Byzantine Empire in the 7th century AD. And this is the main reason why, is they were badly split between the Chalcedonians and the Monophysites. The Chalcedonians primarily in Greece, the Balkans in Asia Minor, and the Monophysites in Syria and Egypt. Now, turn in your Bibles to Mark 3, 20 to 27. This is very interesting. Mark 3, 20 to 27. It's as well in Matthew 12, 22 to 28. Hear now the words of God. Then the multitude came together again so that they could not so much as eat bread. But when his own people heard about this, they went out to lay hold of him, for they said, he is out of his mind. And the scribes who came down from Jerusalem said, he has Beelzebub. And by the ruler of the demons, he casts out demons. Like he has Satan. By the ruler of the demons, he cast out demons. So he called them to himself. Christ called them to himself and said to them in parables, how can Satan cast out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. There's the fundamental principle. Underline it, circle it. We will see it play out first with the Byzantine Empire, and then we're going to see it play out in the Middle Ages by Islam itself. The Islamic Empire will get fractured, which will give room for the Crusades to come in and reconquer what had once been Christian lands because the Islamic people become divided. Okay? So Mark 3:24, if a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And that's what Jesus is saying. Obviously, based on that fundamental principle, no matter what you apply it to, if you apply it to the Byzantine Empire, if you apply it to the Islamic Empire, if you apply it to Satan's kingdom. If Jesus was casting out demons out of people by Satan, he's casting out Satan by Satan. That would be ludicrous, right? He's showing the absurdity of their logic to blame his power on Satan. If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. And if a house is divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And if Satan has risen up against himself and is divided, he cannot stand and has an end. No one can enter a strong man's house and plunder his goods unless he first binds the strong man and then he will plunder his house. Jesus, I come in and I bind up Satan and then I plunder his house. I cast out the demons. This is a warning shot for you and I in America today. The United States of America. We are very divided. In the history of politics, the divide now between Democrats and Republicans is huge. And how the Democrats are ever more embracing communism, ever more embracing wokeism and transgenderism, ever more embracing anti-capitalism, ever more embracing abortion. And a house divided against itself cannot stand. A kingdom divided against itself cannot stand. We're in a perilous position when we're very divided. It's important to be unified on core truths, core principles. We're going to see that tonight. If we don't learn from the lessons of history, we are bound to repeat them, right? So the Byzantine Empire in the 7th century AD, in the 600s AD, was badly split between the Chalcedonians. Remember from the Chalcedon Creed, 451 AD, clearly defined the person of Christ. Truly God, truly man, two natures in one person, right? The monophysites, physites is for nature, trying to say Jesus is only of one nature. That there's somehow this weird blending of human and divine, one nature. No, he's two natures in one person. That's what the Chalcedon Creed is asserting, right? But they were badly divided. The Chalcedonians were in Greece, the Balkans, and Asia Minor, and had the official position of the Byzantine Empire at this time, centered out of Constantinople, present-day Turkey, Istanbul. The Monophysites, though, in Syria and Egypt. Remember, Syria had its own language, Syriac, and Egypt, its own language, Coptic. Language divides. We can go all the way back to the Tower of Babel. Language divides. When people don't speak the same language, it tends to divide people groups. Well, Syria and Egypt, then, they were Monophysites. They did not like the Byzantine Empire because the Byzantine Empire officially embraced the Chalcedonian Creed. What broke out from 606 to 629 was called the Persian Wars. Persia at this time, where was Persia? Present-day Iran. Okay, to the east. Present-day Iran. And Persia was pagan at this moment. Pagan. In the Persian Wars, 606 to 629 AD, Persia, as pagan, conquered Syria, Antioch, Palestine, where Jerusalem was, and Egypt, where Alexandria was. It's amazing how great the divide was between the Chalcedonians and the Monophysites that those in Syria and Egypt viewed the pagan Persians as liberators. Now think of that a minute. The Monophysites are claiming to be Christians. They have this great disagreement about the nature of Christ, and they view the pagan Persians that conquered them as liberators from the Byzantine Empire. In those Persian wars, though, toward the end of them, in 622 to 628, the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius, who was emperor of 610 to 641 AD, the Byzantine Emperor Heraclius destroyed the Persian Empire. Okay? So the Persian Empire, as pagans came in and initially got Syria, Antioch, Palestine, and Egypt, the Byzantine Emperor responds with his military and destroys the Persian Empire. Heraclius's military forces returned home because they were stretched too thin across the Persian Empire. They didn't have enough troops. They had to come back home to protect the homeland. Think about that a minute. Then that left Persia defeated, no military there really, and open for an Islamic conquest. Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments and his ways past finding out. Romans 11:33. There is a sense in which he's prepared the way for the Islamic hordes to come in and take all of that area. Present day Iran. They're still there. But it started with the pagans taking the initiative and the Byzantine military responding, but their troops weren't numerous enough, so they had to pull back once they defeated and wiped out Persia, but then all that area is left open for the Islamic military hordes. Okay, number four in the outline, the Islamic conquests. The Islamic conquests. After Muhammad's death in 632 AD, many Arabian tribes rebelled against his successor, the caliph that followed him, named Abu Bakr, B-A-K-R. He was caliph for 2 years, 632 to 634. He was able to subdue the rebellion of the pagan tribal groups and bring back order. His successor is Omar, who's the second caliph, O-M-A-R, Omar. He was caliph from 634 to 644, 10 years. He's the one who began the Islamic conquest of the Byzantine Empire. Second successor to Muhammad began a military conquest of the Byzantine Empire. They spread by preaching, writing, diplomacy, politics, and if you're not going to submit, they spread by war. The Muslims took Jerusalem in 637 AD. They took Syria in 639 AD. They took Egypt in 641 AD. And here again, Syria and Egypt now viewed the Muslims as liberators because of their great divide over the Chalcedonian Monophysite controversy and the bad blood that was there. The triumph of the Islamic armies was due to the theological differences and quarrels and fights in the Byzantine Empire. By not having agreement on core truths. Now you got to think to yourself, remember there were five patriarchs in the Catholic Church. Patriarch is fathers, remember? Five fathers, five popes, you could say. We usually call the one in Rome pope, but patriarch, Rome. And then you had Alexandria in Egypt. Egypt just got conquered by Muslims. And then there was a patriarch in Jerusalem. Palestine just got conquered. And then there was one in Antioch, a patriarch in Antioch. That just got conquered. So you only have two left, two patriarchs, two popes left. One in Constantinople, capital of the Byzantine Empire, and one in Rome. So you've got this east-west clarity then between two leaders in the Catholic Church at this point. Because of the Islamic conquests of Egypt with Alexandria, Palestine with Jerusalem, and Antioch. You get me? So it's these Islamic conquests then that paved the way for the eventual separation of East-West. that will be the great schism in the 11th century AD, 400 years after this. In 639 AD, another Muslim army conquered Persia. They were weakened. And just to note, in the 700s, 100 years after this, in the 8th century, Islamic armies will conquer Afghanistan. So they're still there. And North India. You have the Kashmir region, where India and Pakistan have been fighting since World War II, and land was divided up, trying to put the Hindus in India and Pakistan and Bangladesh with the Muslims on each side, where there's disputed territory with Kashmir, where they've been killing each other for years. But this goes all the way back to this period of time. Muslims conquered Cyprus in 648 AD, but it had been Christian territory, the Byzantine Empire, that island in the Mediterranean. Muslims conquered Cyprus in 648 AD, as well as Armenia. You remember Armenia, just east of Asia Minor, east of present-day Turkey, it was the first country, the first kingdom to establish Christianity as its official religion. Remember Gregory the Illuminator? Their establishment of Christianity came before Rome did it, before the Roman Empire. It was right around 300 AD that Armenia, well, here, they're conquered 350 years later, basically, by Islamic military troops. Well, the fifth caliph or caliphate was Muawiyah. Muawiyah. Pronounce that 18 times. M-U-A-W-I-Y-A-H. It's almost as hard to pronounce as some Korean names. For me. Muawiyah. He was the fifth caliphate from 661 to 680 AD. He's the one who turned his swords, his guns, on Constantinople, the capital of the Byzantine Empire, the capital of Catholic Christianity, really, at that time. The five-year siege, violent siege against Constantinople, that city, from 673 to 678 AD. It was at Constantinople in this battle, the Battle of Salaeum, S-Y-L-L-A-E-U-M, particularly in 678 AD, but it was at Constantinople the first time the Muslims met total failure and defeat militarily. First time, right here. The Christians defended their capital with whatever means they could. By the grace of God, they had a new weapon. The Byzantine Empire, they called it Greek fire. One source I read called it sea fire. Nick Needham, in his 2,000 Years of Christ's Power, in his volume, he records it as Greek fire. And there were different names for it. Okay, it ravaged armies and ships, the secret weapon. It was a chemical mixture that burned furiously when contacting water. It became the nuclear bomb of medieval warfare. The way you could win, period. What was it? Nick Needham doesn't say. That's all basically what I gave you is what he says. And I began thinking just like your own mind. Well, what in the world was it? Well, I did some research on it. It was such a secret weapon for the Byzantine Empire, they didn't write it down. Nobody knows what it is. Now, scholars looked at description of what it did is all over, okay? So they looked at the descriptions, scientifically the descriptions of what it did, and this is what they've come up with. Near the Black Sea, Caucasus region, right in there, there's natural light crude petroleum that bubbles up to the surface. Light crude petroleum. And you, if you know, that gets on water with certain mixture, and they think it was with sulfur and like a pitch from a tree, which is highly flammable, right? And that mixture, light crude petroleum with a pitch from a tree and sulfur, burns ferociously, even on water. And they'd have ways of shooting it out of tube, like a thing, to the armies or to the ships. And it was like their nuclear bomb at that time. By the grace of God, they had this. You better come up with something, otherwise you're going to get wiped out by the Islamic hordes. Kill or be killed. This is the idea of a just war. It's defensive. They attacked us. We're defending life and property. We've got women and children, etc. This is our way of life. And they attacked us. Augustine of Hippo fits completely his theory of a just war from the Bible. Of what the Christians were fighting. The Byzantine Empire were fighting a just war against the Islamic armies. And by the grace of God, they had this Greek fire as a secret weapon. Now, nobody wrote it down. It was lost. They kept it such a secret. That's the idea, is the recipe was lost of this chemical mixture in history. Also, a storm at sea smashed the Muslim fleet. That helped. Smiling Providence. Smiling Providence. That's where I put various verses, Psalm 103:19, Daniel 4:35, Psalm 115:3, Ephesians 1:11. It's like God causing the wheels of the chariots of the Egyptians to fall off. Remember? The Egyptians are chasing the Israelites, catch up with them, and God caused the wheels to fall off, the chariots of the Egyptian troops. Where here, God caused a storm to come up too. They had the secret weapon, and then God caused a storm to help take out their Muslim fleet of ships. And our God is in the heavens. He's established his throne in the heavens. His sovereignty rules over all. God does whatever he pleases in the hosts of heaven and among the inhabitants of the earth. And no one can ward off his hand or say, what have you done? He does according to his will, even causing a storm to arise if he wants to. He does whatever he pleases. Psalm 115:3. He works all things after the counsel of his will. Ephesians 1:11. He did not decree that the Muslim forces would take Constantinople. The Byzantine emperor at the time was Constantine IV. He was emperor 668 to 685 AD. Totally wiped out the Muslim army at the Battle of Sulaim, Sylaeum, in 678 AD. In 679, a year after that Battle of Sulaim, Constantine IV and the Caliph Muawiyah, they ceased fighting and they recognized each other's territories, whatever they had taken up to that point. It's called a truce. So this is in the eastern part then of the Byzantine Empire. Remember what occurred right after this. In fall of 680 going into 681 was the Third Council of Constantinople. Remember the heretics that said, you know, in Christ's nature, it's unified in energy. Or in Christ's nature, it's unified in will, monothelites. And this, they rejected that in the Third Council of Constantinople. But you've got to have peace before you have a council. Remember, that's the same in the 300s. It was after Constantine and his conversion in 312 AD, the Battle of Milvian Bridge, that allowed the Council of Nicaea in 325. Finally, the Christians weren't being persecuted in the midst of death. You're able to have bishops travel and meet at a council, right? Same thing here. So then they were able to have the Third Council of Constantinople to also reject other heresies that were arising about the nature of Christ in 680 to 681. You say, what's occurring in the West at this time? Now, in the West, Muslim armies moved into Northwest Africa from Egypt. 50 years took place of savage fighting. The native tribal groups were called Berbers in Northwest Africa. Berbers. They had their own language, Berber language. Okay. The Berbers were defeated after 50 years of savage fighting with the Islamic military armies. The Berbers then embraced Islam, becoming strict and zealous Muslims. In 711 AD, an Islamic Berber army went into Visigoth, Spain. Remember that Germanic tribal group, the Visigoths, are the ones who finally settled down in Spain. And they came to Catholic faith. This is Catholic Spain that the Islamic Berber army attacks. So they attack in 711 AD, and by 718 AD, they conquered almost all of it. In 7 years, they conquered all of Catholic Spain. And then they set their sights on France. further north from Spain. At Tours, T-O-U-R-S, the city in northwest France, at Tours, they were met by a Frankish Catholic army. In 732 A.D., now think, this is 100 years exactly after the death of Muhammad. He died 632, this is 732 A.D. The Muslim general Abdurrahman fought one of the decisive battles of world history against Frankish general Charles Martel. Interestingly, this guy Charles Martel, this general for the French, is Catholic. Martel in French means hammer. So the Islamic army met a hammer that crushed them. Okay? Charles Martel. It's the Battle of Tours. This is one to remember in your mind. It is, as Nick Needham says, one of the decisive battles of world history, changed world history, the total trajectory of world history, right here. 732 AD, the Battle of Tours. It was a decisive victory for Charles and the Franks and the Catholics, permanently halting the Western progress of the Islamic Empire, is exactly what Nick Needham says. Permanently halting the Western progress of the Islamic Empire. Except in our day, they're mass immigrating in. It's only a matter of time right now. If they all get to vote, which they are voting, because diplomacy and politics is part of their religion, how to spread it. Western Europe is overrun right now with Muslims, most of which are young military men, the age group. I have several books on my shelf about the death of Europe, demographically, culturally. It's just a matter of time. 732. The Franks here forced the Muslims back into Spain by the general Charles Martel with his hammer. The Catholic Franks forced the Muslims back into Spain, where they stayed for the next 700 years. This was 732. And the Muslims controlled what had once been Catholic Spain for the next 700 years. In 1492, how many of you remember what happened in 1492? Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Yes, that's right. This is a key date. In 1492 AD, the great Spanish Catholic king, Ferdinand of Castile and Aragon, you say, well, what's that? Take a Portugal and Spain. Well, at that time, Castile and Aragon were territories controlled by Catholic Christians. It wasn't technically Spain, okay? But he's the Spanish king, kind of exiled in a sense. But over Castile and Aragon, these Christian territories, Ferdinand in 1492 finally expelled the Muslims by military force back to North Africa, where they came from, and allowed then Columbus then to sail the ocean blue to discover North America. The Spanish Christian-Muslim conflict and the Christian triumph over the Muslims here in Spain is called the Reconquest by historians. Reconquest, retaking what had once been Christian territory and land. The unity of the Islamic Empire was at first quite impressive, but it did not last. The third caliph, Othman, he's the one that collected all the various copies. Remember, there was no printing press, right? So they had to make copies of the Quran. It was this third caliph that collected all the various contradictory copies and burned them, and only kept one that he felt was the official 114 messages from Allah. But the third caliph here, Othman, was murdered in 656 AD. He was murdered in 656 AD. An assassination took place. Muslims became divided into two parties. This is one of the reasons he was murdered. And these two parties are still around today, still hating one another. Remember the early 1980s, there was the long Iraq-Iran war between the Shia in Iran and the Sunnis in Iraq. They hate one another. Muslims divided into two parties shortly after Muhammad's death, Shias and Sunnis. The Shias, S-H-I-A-S, the Shias argued the Islamic Empire leader, whoever leads the Islamic Empire, which is always political and religious, united, whoever leads the Islamic Empire must be a blood descendant of Muhammad, according to the Shias. According to the Shias, a living leader then, called an imam, I-M-A-M, the living leader, then imam, must be chosen by God from Muhammad's family, a blood relative. What did Sunnis believe? Well, Sunnis argued that the various leaders within Islam should freely elect each caliph. So again, they've taken over various countries, right? And the various leaders of various countries that are Islamic then should be picking the new caliph. Or the caliph can appoint his successor, who that would be, according to the Sunnis. They're okay with either of those. But whoever the leader is does not have to be a blood descendant of Muhammad, according to the Sunnis. Either one picked by the caliph, who would be the successor, or one chosen by the various leaders within Islam. But according to the Sunnis, the living leader does not have to be a blood descendant of Muhammad. The Sunnis argued that the Hadith, the Quran, and the Ijma were more important than who the living leader was. So that the writings were more important, in a sense, of the Hadith, the traditional sayings, and what Muhammad did as a model to follow in the writings of the Hadith, the 114 surahs or messages that are in the Quran, and the Ijma, I-J-M-A, is the collective consensus of the legal scholar. That was more important. Those three things were more important than the living leader, according to the Sunnis. Uthman, he was the third. He was murdered in 656 A.D. He was a Sunni, Uthman. And that murder plunged the Islamic Empire into its first civil war. He was assassinated and killed and murdered, 656. He was a Sunni, and his death plunged the Islamic world into a civil war, its first civil war. Who replaced him? He'd been Sunni. Who replaced him? A Shia, a Shiite, which probably means they're the ones that murdered him. Ali, A-L-I, is a descendant of Muhammad. And he emerged as the fourth caliph, who replaced Uthman. The Sunnis murdered, the third caliph replaced by a Shia caliph, Ali. Well, Ali was murdered in 661, just 5 years later. He's murdered. Who replaced him? So Ali was Shia. Well, a Sunni replaced him. So they're going back and forth, right? Sunnis murdered and replaced by a Shia. He's murdered, replaced by a Sunni. You see? Well, the one that replaced Ali is Muawiyah that we've talked about. Muawiyah. He's the fifth caliph. He's a Sunni. He's the one that turned his guns on Constantinople with the five-year siege at Constantinople. He was pretty astute at balancing this tension between Shia and Sunni. So he didn't suffer assassination. Okay? He died in 680 AD. Fighting again broke out after his death. During that fighting that took place after Muawiyah's death, one of the Shia leaders died in the midst of that fighting, a martyr's death, and that introduced suffering and martyrdom into Islamic theology that's so prominent today. This is where that came from. After the fifth caliph died, fighting broke out, and one of those Shia leaders died a martyr's death, totally outnumbered and went ahead anyway fighting and just was martyred in their civil war. And then that introduced suffering and martyrdom into Islamic theology that's still around today, that martyrs get a special number of virgins in heaven, supposedly. What's interesting is Shias were always a minority in Islam, roughly 10 to 15%. So 85 to 90% of all Muslims have always been Sunni. Shia have been the minority at 10 to 15%. And guess where they've been concentrated? Persia, which is present-day Iran. That's why the Islamic Revolution in 1979 was a really big deal for the rise of the Shias, causing great problems in the world and against Sunnis. And what Trump's doing is a big deal because, in a sense, he's on the side of the Sunnis for American interests, because since 1979, for 47 years, all Iran has done, these Shias, has killed Americans in addition to killing Sunnis. They were behind the IEDs that killed and maimed all sorts of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. Shia Muslims, Iran. Iran's been behind Hezbollah, Hamas, the Houthis, all these terrorist groups across the Middle East. In 756 AD, now this is where we're going to look here at how Islam became fractured. A kingdom divided against itself cannot stand, right? This is where their kingdom, their Islamic empire, is going to become fractured. Just like the Byzantine Empire was at the beginning of all of this, 100 years earlier. In 756 AD, Muslim Spain separated from the rest of the Islamic Empire. So we're going to govern ourselves under the religion of Islam. Muslim Spain in 756, they went independent. So in the 700s, in the 8th century AD, in the 700s, during that whole period of time, Shia Persia became independent as well, said we're going to govern ourselves as Shia Muslims. Others that went independent across Northwest Africa, Morocco, Tunisia, and Libya went independent, governing themselves however they wanted to govern themselves under the Islamic religion. In the 10th century, in the 900s AD, Egypt became an independent Muslim kingdom, governing themselves however they wanted to under the Islamic religion. In the 900s AD. All of that fracturing and independence paved the way for the Western Catholic conquest, say reconquest, of the Middle East by the Crusaders in the 11th century AD. Many look at the Crusades as controversial in our day, but to a great extent they're trying to take back by military force what had once been Christian territory. But all of that fractioring then made them weak. They weren't unified, the Islamic Empire, anymore. They're all governing themselves and independent, so they're not as loyal to each other then at that point. As Christianity did, Islam developed different traditions and schools of thought. That's the last thing we're going to look at here before we close this evening. Just as Christianity did, Islam developed different traditions and schools of thought. Two of Islam's greatest thinkers were the Persian Avicenna, A-V-I-C-E-N-N-A. The Persian Avicenna, he lived 980 to 1037 A.D. And the Spanish Averroes, A-V-E-R-R-O-E-S. The Spanish Averroes, he lived 1126 to 1198 A.D. who translated the Greek philosopher Aristotle's writings into Arabic. His writings were rediscovered. They were in Greek and translated them into Arabic, which Christian scholars translated then into Latin. And that had a great, massive impact upon Western Catholic theology as Christian scholars were reading Aristotle's works. And if you know anything about Thomas Aquinas, lived in the 13th century, the 1200s AD, he, in a sense, wrote his Summa describing Christianity in Aristotelian terms. So there are thinkers. That's the point to see on this. There are some great thinkers within the Islamic religion that think about metaphysics and ethics and all sorts of things, okay, in the Middle Ages. How about on mysticism? We've covered some on mysticism within Christianity. Muslim mystics were called Sufis. S-U-F-I-S. So the pronunciation, it's pronounced as Sufi. It's because of the woolen garments that they wore, these mystics. That's why they're named that. They wore certain clothing, certain woolen garments. Well, these Muslim mystics, similarly, just like the Christian mystics, the Muslim mystics, Sufis, were influenced by Neoplatonism. Influenced by Neoplatonism. Neo means a new form of Plato's philosophy that became a religious philosophical system under Plotinus, roughly 100 years before Augustine of Hippo. Augustine of Hippo died 430 AD. Remember, Augustine of Hippo was roughly 10 years as a Manichae, which was a Gnostic sect, and then he became a Neoplatonist. After some skepticism, he became a Neoplatonist. And it was Neoplatonism that he ascribes why he became a Christian, because of how metaphysics and God were described within Neoplatonism. And literally in his confessions that he wrote, that's how he was brought to Christianity. His dying words were from Plotinus, founder of Neoplatonism. The great Christian Augustine of Hippo was very much an intellectual, but he was very much as well loved the transcendence of God and the mysticism that's there. Now, this one scholar I end here with, you know, think of this name. That's a long one. I don't think that would fit on a football jersey. Abu Hamid Muhammad al-Ghazali. Say that again. This is the guy's name. Abu Hamid Muhammad al-Ghazali. He lived 1058 to 1111 AD. From 1058 to 1111 AD. Nick Needham points out he blended a highly intellectual Islamic theology. You know, they were studying Aristotle. You study Aristotle, you're studying great intellect. But he blended a highly intellectual Islamic theology with a heartfelt Sufi mysticism. And what Nick Needham kind of says is that this gentleman here, this scholar, is on the Muslim side just like Augustine of Hippo is on the Christian side. Because what Augustine of Hippo did on the Christian side, he blended a highly intellectual Christian theology with a very heartfelt mysticism and said the essence of the city of God is love, love of God. But it's important for us to recognize that there is diversity within the Islamic faith. Some core truths, the five pillars. In his five pillars, he starts with the confession of faith, number one, there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. Then goes into charitable giving, almsgiving. Say they have a duty, Allah's will is to give money to the poor. They're about prayer, but they say you have to pray five times a day facing Mecca. Five times a day facing Mecca. And then fasting. Fasting for them is required during the holy month of Ramadan. Fifth, everybody needs to try and make one pilgrimage to Mecca in their lifetime. The jihad, the holy war, personal and public. There's the way it spreads. And if you don't submit to preaching, to writing and diplomacy politics, warfare's coming. This has been the whole history of Islam. Okay? Right now, they're immigrating into the Western world, what had once been Christendom, and they are engaged in preaching. They're engaged in writing, and they're engaged in diplomacy politics. If they don't finally get their way through diplomacy politics, take a guess what's coming. Lord willing, the next time we meet, we're going to look at the life for the church under Islamic rule. That's the plan. So they took over all these areas within 100 years of what had once been Catholic Christianity, what was Christian life then for the church under Islamic rule in these areas dominated by Islam?